We're talking with Milwaukee's interim health commissioner here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Marlena Jackson assumed the role in September following the departure of Jeanette Kowalik. Jackson joined the health department as deputy commissioner of community health in April amid this health crisis, managing pandemic guidance for schools, for childcare, and faith-based organizations. And she worked for Frederick Hospital for 15 years prior to that. What do you want to ask the city's interim commissioner of health? What support or guidance do you need from the city of Milwaukee Health Department? What about vaccine distribution? Join in at 800-642-1234. Interim commissioner of health, Marlena Jackson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Well,
happy to be here.
Thank you. Let's start with the vaccine. The vaccine reached frontline healthcare workers in Milwaukee a month ago. Bring us up to speed on the vaccination rollout in your city.
Sure. So actually, the city of Milwaukee just received our first doses of vaccine last Thursday. So today actually makes day six for the city of Milwaukee receiving our actual vaccinations. And we did receive the Pfizer vaccine. So we have been distributing the Pfizer vaccine to the 1A category groups, which for the city of Milwaukee are the Milwaukee Health Department frontline staff, as well as the Milwaukee Firefighter EMS staff. So between the two of those groups, that includes individuals that are doing all of our screenings, our public health nurses, as well as our home visitors under our community health and consumer health programs as well.
And this week, the Wisconsin Center, the convention center downtown in Milwaukee, opened as a vaccination site. How are you using this facility?
Yeah, so we're really excited about it. So the Wisconsin Center was gracious enough to offer us their space, and we were able to really optimize using the larger spaces. As you know, with COVID-19, one of the mitigation steps to preventing disease spread is to have space and to be at least 6 feet apart. So to be able to have a space as large as a Wisconsin Center allows the Milwaukee Health Department to still hold larger vaccination sites while having individuals have enough space to still not spread the disease or not have the event be a super spreader event. So we're super excited about it. There are a number of different stations. There's a registration table or station. There's also consent areas, and then you move on to your actual vaccination station, and then there is a large observation station. So there are stations that are spaced out. Each individual team stays in their stations, and so today is actually day four for the Wisconsin Center, and it has gone extremely smooth.
How many people have been vaccinated there to date?
Yeah, so as of yesterday, we had vaccinated around 615 people at the Wisconsin Center. That's not including the additional 200 that we vaccinated last week. Again, that's a bit of a mix of Milwaukee Health Department staff, the firefighter EMS group, as well as we've actually been able to fit some of our unaffiliated healthcare workers that also fall in Group 1A into our schedule.
I'm looking at the county COVID data dashboard right now. More than 21,700 doses have been administered in Milwaukee County, not the city, but 60% mm-hmm. of those shots going to white people. How is that being addressed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think one of the things to really understand as we look at the groups, the roles that are being prioritized first, which are, again, the healthcare workers. When you look, I think, at the demographic of what that general healthcare worker group makes up, that encompasses white individuals as well as younger individuals, 25 to 34 years old. And so right now we understand that's the demographic of EMS, that's the demographic of general health care workers across the city and across the industry generally. And so what we know for the city of Milwaukee, where we have 40% African-American, where we have 19% Hispanic and a growing Hmong and refugee population, that we have some work to do and some catch up to do when that time is right, when we're ready to move into that next phase of general public. We understand we've got some catch up to do to get those numbers to be much more equal. And we've already started that planning, working with churches, African-American churches, as well as reaching out to the Mexican consulate here in the city to make sure that we're addressing and being really equitable when we look at the end of all of this work that we're going to do.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Marlena Jackson. She's interim health commissioner for the city of Milwaukee, has held the position since September. We're looking at the vaccine rollout and how the city is battling COVID with your questions as well. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Lisa in Madison with a question. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I understand there is concerns regarding if anybody has experienced anaphylaxis. Does that extend to if the anaphylaxis was a result of like bees, wasps, hornet, yellow jacket stings?
Commissioner, can you field that?
Yeah. So what we understand right now is that the conduit to hold the actual vaccine, there's different ones for Pfizer versus Moderna. And what we understand is that is not necessarily the case. It's really based off of individuals who are at higher risk for having allergic reactions, generally speaking. If you look at the general vaccines that are out around the nation, whether it's measles, mumps, chicken pox, or flu, they all use a different conduit. And generally, individuals that have allergic reactions to one vaccine tend to be at higher risk for having reactions to another vaccine, not necessarily related to the conduit always, but generally it's about an individual's kind of genetic makeup.
What is the breakdown of the amount of Pfizer vaccine rolling into Milwaukee versus Moderna?
So right now, the city of Milwaukee has received all Pfizer vaccine.
Okay.
We have not received any Moderna, and we're working really close. I would have to just say that our state partners have worked really diligently to make sure that our delivery of vaccine, of the Pfizer vaccine, which you know has to be stored at sub-zero temperatures, that we're able to get those deliveries frequently that don't jeopardize the integrity of the actual vaccine.
Are you looking to, when rollout is more widespread, are you looking to expand beyond the Wisconsin Center for a larger delivery of vaccine to your residents?
Yes. One thing we do know is that, you know, as you look at these groups and we progress through our natural prioritization, so going from group 1A healthcare providers and EMS staff, moving to group B, which is police officers and first responders and teachers and essential workers, on to group 1C, which is elderly adults and other essential workers. We know that these groups are going to get larger and larger and larger exponentially. And so because of that, we're going to use Wisconsin Center as just one site, one mass site. And we're also looking at using the Miller Park Brewers site as another a potential drive-through site for vaccinations. We wanted to start at the Wisconsin Center again because it gives us the space to physically observe people at a really good distance while optimizing our staffing, so that if there were any reactions, we would be able to be right there and available to act swiftly. As we feel more comfortable with the vaccine moving forward, we will then, again, look at larger sites like Miller Park for drive-through. And then also, just to, you know, go back to the other point around making sure that African-Americans, that older adults who maybe don't have the same abilities to get to a particular site, that we are going out in the communities, whether that's through the churches or the schools or beauty salons or barbershops, to do what are called smaller mobile strike teams and having more isolated events in those spaces that, again, address the disparity issue.
Marlena Jackson is Interim Health Commissioner for the City of Milwaukee Health Department. What do you want to know about access to testing, to the status of contact tracing, and when a vaccine will reach you? What do you want the city's health department to focus on to know in this moment in the pandemic? 800-642-1234 to join in. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're checking in with Milwaukee's Interim Health Commissioner on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The first doses of the COVID vaccine have reached frontline healthcare workers in the city in recent days, but the largest vaccination campaign in our history is off to a slow start, and public health workers are concerned about vaccine hesitancy and a lack of trust among communities of color. Are you waiting and wondering when it will be your turn? Are you unsure whether you'll get the vaccine? What do you want to know from Milwaukee's Health Department? It's 800-642-1234. Marlena Jackson is Interim Health Commissioner for the City of Milwaukee, and she's with us for about nine more minutes. Let's bring in Nancy now in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hello to you. I'm concerned about the fact that this Pfizer vaccine has to be diluted. I'm wondering if Pfizer sends along the diluent, or whether, because it's sent to many locations, if everybody at these various locations is using the same diluent. I'm wondering about the fact that once it's been thawed and diluted, how many times are needles going to be stuck into this container? In other words, I'm worried about contamination of the final diluted product. And I'm concerned about the fact that when people come back in 3 weeks for their second shot, they're not possibly at all going to be able to get the same lot number with the same expiration date.
Commissioner, can you address those concerns?
Sure. Thanks. Those are really good questions. As it relates to the diluent that we use, so the Pfizer vaccine, as well as I understand, I have not had, again, direct experience with the Moderna vaccine, but they all come with the diluent. So so the manufacturer sends that along with the actual vaccine. So that should be consistent across the distribution that's given out. So know that as far as that is concerned, that is really a very consistent process. As it relates to the handling of it, so what I can share with you, at least with the City of Milwaukee, and I suspect other places, because we understand that this vaccine is such a precious commodity, the steps that we have gone through to make sure that we are not wasteful, the steps that we have gone through to make sure that a minimum amount of individuals are actually handling the vaccine as it gets moved from freezer to the area where we actually do the diluting and the mixing to the actual nurse that does the vaccinations. We have brought that to a minimum. We don't have runners that do that. It goes straight from the individual who pulls it out of our freezers into the hand of the vaccination nurse, and then into the arm. So we've really done our best to try to minimize that. As with any kind of environment where we're doing vaccines, there are all of the normal standard safety precautions that we're following as far as sterile processes when necessary and gloving and those kind of things.
What about having the same lot number for the second dose?
Yeah, good question. So we would not have the same lot number per dose. Again, there, as with Pfizer vaccine, there's a 28-day difference between when you first get your first shot and then when you need to come back to get your booster shot. So the lot numbers are not the same, but I can tell you that information too, as far as individuals getting the second shot, that's all been studied. And you know, what we know is that those two vaccines that are not necessarily same lot number are still what are giving individuals that effectiveness rate of over 95%.
We're talking with Marlena Jackson, Interim Health Commissioner with the City of Milwaukee, answering your questions amid the pandemic at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us from Stevens Point. Hi, Chris. What would you like to add?
Hi, I was wondering, I'm sure there's a priority in who will receive the vaccines first. Obviously, the health workers need that. But I'm wondering, you know, we have so many.
Oh, Chris, I think we just lost you. And Chris was asking, we have so many teachers in our state. Chris says they need the vaccine. When will teachers be vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. So the State Disaster Medical Advisory Group, which is the advisory committee that has worked and taken recommendations from the federal government and then looked at the state of Wisconsin and looked at our demographic and our disease burden across the state and has made the decision that education, teachers, and daycares fall in our 1B category. So as a state right now, we are still in 1A, which includes, again, the healthcare workers and EMS staff. We will be moving, I suspect, very soon into Group 1B, which includes the safety, public safety, police, as well as the education group. So just hold on. I think it's coming.
Let's turn to guidance to schools in the pandemic. The Milwaukee Teachers Education Association is accusing the city health department of meeting regularly with private school leaders and drafting reopening guidelines. And this is according to emails obtained by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, hundreds of them. Have private schools been at an advantage to getting their needs met over public schools?
Yeah, good. You know, that's a question I'm happy to say that the private schools have not received an advantage. One of the tactics that the Milwaukee Health Department used since the beginning of the pandemic as it relates to our Moving Milwaukee Forward Safely orders that impact schools, restaurants, daycares, and churches, along with other businesses and establishments in the city, is to really, first of all, acknowledge that we are not the subject matter experts when it comes to individual establishments. The health department and the role of public health is to understand how disease burden works and understand where and how to track and decrease burden. So what we did from the beginning was engage both the City of Milwaukee, Milwaukee Public Schools, as well as private school groups. We also did that with our bars and restaurants. Actually, they were the first group that we met independently with to have conversations about what does it mean when we tell you as a city of Milwaukee that you can only open at 25% capacity or 50% capacity. How do we best make sure that the rules and the guidelines that we know keep people safe, that you are able to operate in that space? And so we also did that with daycares, and we also did that with churches. And so that's been one of the tactics, again, that we have used across the board. And I think it's really one of the best ways to make sure that the health department is engaged with every single sector, private schools, public schools, bars and restaurants, churches, daycares, across the board, to make sure that we are working together. The whole idea is that communication happens and we're working together to fight COVID-19.
Milwaukee officials have said testing is underutilized. What barriers stand in the way of more residents getting tested?
That is such a great question, and I wish I had the 100% golden answer to that. We peaked around testing about 8-9 weeks ago now, and we've had a slow decline over time since about Thanksgiving. About a week after Thanksgiving, we started to see declines in testing. And, you know, I think there is a combination of reasons why our testing has gone down. I think vaccinations have ramped up. A lot of attention around COVID-19 has been around vaccinations and the cure and moving into a different space, while in reality, we really are still in the midst of a disease where in the city of Milwaukee, we're at about a little bit under 9% positivity rate for the community. And so individuals, I think as a country and as a city, we want to move past COVID-19, and we, you know, are ready for our vaccine, and maybe testing is down because of that. I think other factors do include trying to get to spots when it's cold, when it's dark, when it's snowing outside. I think all of those environmental factors also play into less testing.
I want to land here on the critical piece of contact tracing. How big is your backlog in contact tracing?
Yeah, so right now we don't have a backlog. We have what we would call our standard backlog, which is about 2 days, which we don't consider that a delay. It takes us about 2 days to get to reach out to individuals once their information comes to us that they have tested positive for COVID. So we are in a really good place for that. We were able to staff up. Unfortunately, you know, part of the kind of give and take of contact tracing is positive cases are best based off of testing. Testing then leads us to have positive cases and then have contact tracing. So we don't want to do contact tracing, right? We want low numbers of positive cases. But if we don't have testing, then we really don't know that that's a real number of that's reflective in the city. And that's the kind of scary part. But we do have, right now, we are not in a backlog in the city of Milwaukee. We are in a really good place for contact tracing.
Commissioner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Marlena Jackson is Interim Health Commissioner for the City of Milwaukee. Ahead this hour, we talk with a constitutional law and election scholar about the House voting to impeach President Trump. News update is next. Stay with us. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Here with us for The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about political opposites ahead of the presidential inauguration.
In 1952, Leonard Schmidt ran against controversial Senator Joseph McCarthy on the Republican ticket in Wisconsin and lost. We recently received a Wisconsin question from a listener who wanted to know more about Schmidt. Liz Domes-Harder brings us the story of a man who rebuked the division and chaos that defined McCarthyism.
In 1952, Senator Joseph McCarthy was already 2 years into his crusade against communism, making unsubstantiated claims that communists and spies were infiltrating the U.S. government and Hollywood. Then, Leonard Schmidt, an attorney from Merrill, Wisconsin, entered his political sphere.
He was a former progressive and a longtime thorn in the side of the conservative Republicans.
That's Larry Tai, an author who's written about McCarthy. Schmidt described his challenger for the U.S. Senate as a liar, a hoax, a demagogue. 70 years later, that word, demagogue, would show up again as the title of Tai's latest book, detailing the life of McCarthy.
So at a moment of great fear in America, Joe McCarthy was a demagogue who capitalized on that fear with lots of simplistic and false promises.
Schmidt was emphatic in his fight for the little fellow. His passion for justice and integrity, along with a nudge from his friend who ran the Capital Times newspaper, convinced Schmidt to run for office. He lost the primary to McCarthy overwhelmingly. But in a time of division, dishonesty, and political corruption, Schmidt was a disciple of decency. His calls for fairness and moral treatment of others would follow him far out of the political spotlight. Nancy Meyer knew Schmidt. She's 85 years old now and lives in Merrill. She first met Schmidt in 1969. He was still a titan of local politics.
I could have been intimidated, but he had a very gracious way about him. I mean, he was a trial lawyer. I'm sure he knew how to handle people.
She was invited to a meeting with him. She had just been named chairperson of the Democratic Party of Lincoln County, where Merrill is located. Lincoln County has a long history of voting red.
At any rate, he congratulated me on winning, if that's what you want to call it, being chairman of the Democratic Party.
She was the first woman to do so. Schmidt was conscious that some might not have approved of a woman in that role.
He felt that because I was a woman and leading a county political party, I might run into some difficulties, resistance, people really not accepting of it. He told me that if I needed any kind of support or advice, that I was always welcome to contact him.
Schmidt believed in political civility. He encouraged engagement, telling young attorneys in his office to get involved in politics, no matter the side. He was progressive, and he was Republican through and through. He served as delegate to the Republican National Convention in 1936 and as district attorney in Lincoln County. He supported Republicans in their political careers throughout his life. McCarthy was a Republican too, and he ran for district attorney. In fact, both men were Roman Catholic. Both were military men. But McCarthy was ruthless.
When they're attacked, bullies like that aim wrecking balls at their assailants.
For his campaign against McCarthy, Schmidt received hundreds of letters of hate mail. He was called Benedict Arnold and a communist. He forged ahead anyway.
He was very unassuming. Boy, he must have been one determined fellow.
A living example that putting people above party, even in chaos, is a legacy that lives on.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on Leonard Schmidt, who ran against Joseph McCarthy. She answered a listener question that came through our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we look at the act of impeachment through the principles of political justice. A number of House Republicans argued impeaching the president so close to inauguration is bad. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said in his speech on the House floor Wednesday that mob law interfered with constitutional law and impeachment would further fan the flames of partisan division.
Most Americans want neither inaction nor retribution. They want durable, bipartisan justice. That path is still available, but is not the path we are on today.
What path are we on as a nation? Does Congress have an obligation to punish the president for inciting rioters to attack the Capitol? If so, what punishment is appropriate? 800-642-1234. Lori Ringhand is a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law and interim director of the Dean Rusk International Law Center. Lori, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What do Democrats and some Republicans hope to get out of this? Because President Trump will leave office in 5 days.
Yeah, so I think the answer to that really lies in the article of impeachment itself, which explains why the elected officials favoring and voting for impeachment and hoping for conviction think this is so important. The article is, there's just one, and it's titled Incitement of Insurrection, which sounds very, very broad. And it is. What the articles lay out is, or the article lays out, it talks about how the president has a duty to ensure the faithful execution of the laws and to defend the Constitution. And then it articulates the ways in which the Congress believes that the president has failed to do that. And it's not just about the speech at the Capitol. The article of impeachment itself talks about the repeated pushing out of false claims about the election and the pressuring of state and local officials to disregard their duties and act in contrary to the results, the election results, and then ultimately includes the president's speech, which led to the violence at the Capitol and the effort to stop the members of the joint session from carrying out their duties in counting the electoral votes. So it together, what this shows us is that what the House is concerned about here is the precedent of this type of effort to discredit the electoral process itself.
You know, one law professor called this a snap impeachment, which is to the Constitution what Snapchat is to social media, a snap impeachment reducing the process to a raw brief and this partisan vote. Is that harmful to our nation?
Well, I think this impeachment happened much faster than the one a year ago did. And I think there are concrete reasons for that. The process has to, or the process can appropriately be responsive to the accusation. And what we saw a year ago when President Trump was impeached for the first time, that impeachment rested on a complicated set of facts. That, of course, was also about election interference, which I think is important. But the underlying facts were much more convoluted and difficult to tease out. They involved the phone call to the Ukrainian president or prime minister and the effort to try to allegedly pressure the Ukraine to develop evidence that would help President Trump or that he believed would help him in a possible run against Joe Biden. That was factually complicated. The impeachment articles this time around are very different in that everything that the impeachers are asserting here happened fully in public. Mm. The facts of what the president did aren't really contested here. So the process matches that. And I don't think that on its own terms is problematic.
But perhaps a hearing would have allowed for a formal demand for a response from the president.
It could have. And of course, the impeachment in the House is just the first step in this process. Uh-huh. It does. It now, as you know, moves to the Senate, and the Senate is structured as a more of a trial. The analogy to criminal law is flawed and incomplete in many ways because impeachment is inherently a political, not a criminal law process. But the analogy often is made that impeachment in the House is like an indictment. You make a preliminary case. And then the process in the Senate is where the president is given space to answer that. So again, that itself is pretty... there's a lot of precedent for a process that works that way within our legal system writ large.
We are talking, if you're just joining us, with Lori Ringhand. She is a constitution scholar at the University of Georgia, and we're looking at the impeachment process. Are you worried impeachment will become a routine action, that President Trump has been impeached twice? 800-642-1234 to join in. Lori, what does a retroactive impeachment trial mean? I mean, because, you know, the Senate is not going to do this, it seems, before Inauguration Day.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And there is a genuine dispute among legal scholars about convicting someone after they have left office. And of course, the impeachment has happened in the House already while the president was in office. But as you point out, any conviction in the Senate will almost certainly occur after the president has left office. And the weight of history weighs in favor of allowing that type of post-tenure process to happen. That we've done this before. We have had impeachments that have resulted in convictions after the person being impeached has left office. So it has precedent. Precedent is on its side. And the point of that would be that the impeachment penalties in the Constitution, if you are impeached and convicted, there's two possible penalties that the Senate can impose. One is removal from office. That would obviously be nonsensical if the person has already left office. And scholars who argue that a post-tenure impeachment process is not permitted point to the fact that removal from office as a penalty implies that the person has to still be holding office. But the second penalty that's permitted under the constitutional text itself very explicitly is a bar to holding future office. And that obviously can be imposed regardless of whether a person is in office or not. So there's the legal question about a post-tenure impeachment. Again, the weight of history weighs in favor of doing that, although, of course, the number of incidences are very small. But there's also a political question about whether the Biden administration will want the Senate tied up in this during, you know, the famous first 100 days.
Right. But going back to ensuring the president doesn't hold office again, isn't that a separate vote following a conviction?
Yes, it is. It's a separate vote following a conviction, but it is forward looking, right?
Okay.
Which is why it weighs in. It's not nullified by the fact that the president is not holding office right now, the way the first remedy of removal is.
We're talking with University of Georgia constitutional law scholar Lori Ringhand about the president's actions in inciting violence on the Capitol and what rises to criminal liability. What do you make of Trump's second impeachment this week? What effects do you think it will have on the presidency, on Congress, on our nation? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lori Ringhand here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation with constitutional law and Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand of the University of Georgia School of Law. We're examining the role of impeachment in our constitutional order and this possibility of retroactive removal of someone who has already left office, how that works. Would a trial and conviction bring closure to you? Has this moment fundamentally altered the role of impeachment in our nation? 800-642-1234. And Lori Ringhand is with us for about nine more minutes. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. What would you like to ask?
Yeah, I have a comment first. This is really nothing but a continuation of the Trump derangement syndrome since we've seen from day one. A second impeachment, it's insane. It's a metaphoric guillotine that's being used. And my concern is we're seeing it in tech and we're seeing it across all our culture is this cancel culture. So is this going to continue by the Democrats moving forward of just canceling anyone that's conservative or right in the center to get them out of the public square?
The abuse of impeachment, Lori?
I think the abuse of impeachment process is something to genuinely be concerned about. I mean, it is an extraordinary remedy, and it would not be good for our politics if it became just a routine political tool. And I think one of the things that may distinguish that and kind of counter that temptation, and it certainly will be a temptation going forward. I think I mentioned this earlier. It's important that both of these impeachment movements involved efforts to discredit or interfere with the electoral process itself. The peaceful transfer of power is quite literally the most important thing we collectively do together as a nation. And what both of these impeachments share is an accusation that's what's being interfered with. That is a categorically different thing than even vehement disagreement about policy issues or vehement disagreement about the appropriate role of tech regulation within our public discourse, which I agree with your caller. That's a very difficult question about how to think about what power private tech companies should exercise over the public discourse. But those are fundamentally questions of public policy. And even strident and loud disagreement about those things is different than efforts to disrupt the very way that we collectively transfer power. And because I think that's why the people moving forward with impeachment think this is important to do. Because if we lose that, then it's very hard to figure out how we're going to live together as a society.
You're a Supreme Court scholar. In a Senate trial, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts would have to decide his role. How do you see that happening?
Yeah, so in the impeachment trials that we've had in the past, the chief justices have been pretty consistent in viewing their role in a fairly procedural way. Chief justices do not want to get embroiled in questions of what this process should look like at a substantive level. So they approach their view as a not quite just ceremonial, but very procedural, kind of ensuring ordered debate that happens in an appropriate way, and leave substantive decisions to chamber managers, the people on the floor, the elected officials who are managing the process on behalf of their side of the debate. And that's pretty consistent, frankly, with how the Supreme Court has handled almost all questions involving impeachment. This is fundamentally a political process. And by political, I want to be clear, I don't mean partisan. If it slips into pure partisanship, like your caller mentioned, that's not great. But it is political in contrast, it's political in the sense that it is a political remedy for a perceived political wrong. It's not a legal judicial court process. And the Supreme Court has very consistently over our entire history declined the invitation to get involved in making substantive decisions about what that process is supposed to look like. And I think it's worth remembering why impeachment process is there. Our founders were very concerned with separation of powers and making sure that no one branch became too powerful. That's what they were very frightened of. So they developed this elaborate system of checks and balances, and the impeachment and conviction power is given to the House and Senate as one of those checks. And it's specifically intended to be, they viewed this as an answer, a way Congress can check a president who is misusing or abusing public power. The high crimes and misdemeanors, the high crimes here are crimes against the body politic. And that's precisely how the impeaching House sees these efforts to interfere with the electoral process.
We're talking with Lori Ringhand, a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law, and we're looking at the complexities of impeachment, how it informs the state of our nation today and in the final days of the Trump presidency. Lori, you know, President Trump broke several longstanding norms of the presidency while in office, including keeping his profitable businesses running, failing to release his taxes, attacking the credibility of our elections and our election processes. How do you see his tenure as changing the role of the presidency?
Well, I think we'll see some legislation to address some of those things that had been norms, but not legal requirements, like perhaps releasing more financial information or divesting yourself of potential conflicts of interest. But I think one of the things I do want to highlight here, because I think it's an unfortunate fact of where we've ended up. We just managed in the middle of a pandemic to hold an election in which more Americans voted than have ever voted before. We should be celebrating that. That's actually a phenomenal accomplishment. The hard work of our state and local officials across this country, thousands of people who got involved and tried to make this work, and thousands of new voters. Trump brought in new voters, and that's great. We want people to vote. And this is really a heck of an accomplishment, and we did it collectively. And it's really unfortunate to me that has been overshadowed and lost, because that's really something to be proud of. This country did that in these circumstances, and that's extraordinary.
Lori, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Lori Ringhand is a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law and the interim director of the Dean Rusk International Law Center, a graduate of the UW-Madison Law School. Just ahead, it is the news, and we'll talk with Dasha Kelly Hamilton, who was recently named the state's next poet laureate, about how she aims to encourage others to take up poetry during the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.